This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, as Cincinnati Streetcar gets ready to open to the public next month, we'll hear how the new streetcar system in Kansas City is doing. First, one in four children in the U.S. grows up without learning how to read. The lack of this valuable skill puts them at a huge disadvantage, not only in getting a proper education, but also in adulthood, when experts say it has an impact on many aspects of life, from health to economic security. Joining us to look at local efforts to promote literacy among children are the director of the Reading and Literacy Discovery Center at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Scott Holland, Cincinnati Children's Hospital Pediatric Primary Care Center attending physician, Dr. Greg, pronounce that for me. I'm sorry, I meant to ask you that when we were getting started.
Shumloss.
Greg Shumloss, thank you, who directs the Reach Out and Read program and Greater Cincinnati Reach Out and Read Coalition, and Dr. John Hutton, who's pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's and owner of the Blue Manatee Children's Bookstore. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good to see everybody. Scott, John, Greg, thank you for being here
this
afternoon.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you. Thank you.
Scott, tell us, what does literacy mean? How's that word defined?
Well, when we talk about literacy, typically we're referring to the ability of an individual to handle prose efficiently and fluently, to be able to read text, extract meaning from that, and use that in their daily life. And it's important to differentiate between literacy, which is, you know, the knowledge of how to read, and neurological-based reading difficulties such as dyslexia. So there can be a couple of different causes for our inability to read fluently. Not being taught to read as a child, not getting good reading instruction in school or at home.
That's one thing.
That's a cause for poor literacy skills. But some kids who are exposed to excellent opportunities to learn to read still struggle with that, and that would be classified as dyslexia.
So how are we doing in the U.S. when it comes to literacy?
Well, your numbers are actually pretty accurate. I just, since I knew I was going to be on here, did a little research yesterday, and it looks like we're at about 19% of U.S. high school graduates who are failing to read at a proficient level. So they're functionally illiterate. They're not able to use, reading as part of their daily operations to get a job or to get through life. The rate drops a little bit if you look at all U.S. residents. It's about 14% of U.S. high school graduates. And I think, we're talking about then people who go back to school later on and learn how to read through the Adult Literacy Network that I know Suzanne Bone has been involved with and other programs. So somewhere between 14 and 19% of the U.S. population is not reading proficiently.
And are the numbers pretty much the same locally, Scott?
Well, that's a good question. They vary quite a bit regionally. They vary a lot by state. Looking at the latest data, it seems like in Ohio, we have about 9% of Ohio residents who are reading below the basic level, which, compared with the state of Mississippi, where it's 16% illiteracy, Ohio's doing pretty well. And if you look at Hamilton County, it's even a little bit better. It's really about 7% of Hamilton County residents who are failing to read proficiently. So it varies regionally and with demographics.
John, what kind of an impact does this have on children?
The effects of reading early on are huge. I mean, traditionally people think of reading as being mostly an academic skill, mm-hmm. The process of reading, learning how to read words and succeed in school, and that's definitely true. In the early years in particular, though, reading can serve as a great catalyst to bring a parent or other grown-up and a child together to create the emotional bond that's so important for physical and mental health. Children that grow up in households where reading is valued, where they were read to, and they have positive feelings about reading, tend to want to read more. They go to school being interested in books, knowing what books are, and then are more interested in being lifelong learners and readers. And then when they become parents, they're more likely to read to their own children. So that early process really is formative for the whole experience.
What are do we have any idea as far as what some of the leading causes of illiteracy are?
Well, there's two main. I mean, one, I'm jumping in for Dr. Holland, but there's essentially two major categories. There's more of a brain-based reading disability, or otherwise known most commonly as dyslexia. Where there's something about the network, the brain network, the structure of the brain, or the function, things we're really just starting to understand on a neurobiological level. And that's about roughly 6% of individuals with learning difficulty or reading difficulty. And then there's a more environmental-based reading difficulty, which has to do with just either inadequate stimulation during the early years, something about the educational environment, interest in books, something to where the networks that would otherwise be able to function properly are not stimulated at certain times in development and just don't form to their best.
And those are the numbers that I was sort of talking about before. In Ohio, about 9% of individuals fall into that category. And it's probably important to note that the 6% of people who have dyslexia are not part of that 9%. When we measure that, you know, on a statewide basis or a nationwide basis, people with refractory reading difficulty are sort of excepted from the testing process. So, you know, when we talk about illiteracy numbers, those are really people who fall into that first category of not having learned to read.
Greg, in terms of health effects, can this lack of being able to read, is it something that affects your health as you go through life?
Most definitely. I think as time goes on, we look at development and reading more as a health problem and not just a separate problem from, you know, your strep throat or your pneumonias or your other problems. So definitely not being able to read well is a lifelong problem, almost can be a disability that greatly affects a person throughout their childhood and adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, reading absolutely can cause health problems both in the short term where, for example, you know, let's say kids go into kindergarten or first grade and are struggling with their ABCs and they just start acting out more and having more behavior problems, don't want to go to school and you know, a lot of just dysfunctional behavior. But then as they get older, the less engaged they are at school and the less successful they're feeling, there can be self-esteem issues, other things that can make them more at risk for substance abuse, teen pregnancy, a lot of the adolescent health issues, and then later on, it's estimated about 70% of the population in prison is illiterate on some level. So it really can snowball from behavioral problems in younger kids to really significant societal problems for adults.
And beyond that, Scott, what are some of the other issues that come about from illiteracy as you get older?
Well, I think, you know, John hit squarely on one of the major issues. You know, if you're not reading well by the third grade, we know that's a prediction of high school graduation rate. So, you know, your chance of being a high school graduate, if you're failing to read by the third grade, drops by 50%. And then we also have seen the progression from dropping out of high school to delinquency to incarceration. And as John mentioned, much higher percentage of prison inmates are, you know, illiterate and failing to read proficiently. So, you know, you can't really say it's necessarily cause and effect, but there's definitely an association with sort of a lifelong disability in terms of employment potential, earning potential, society burden. And so, you know, teaching kids to read early is really a critical issue. It's one of the reasons why Ohio has taken the initiative putting the third grade reading guarantee in place. That's legislation that was passed in the state of Ohio in 2013 that was really designed sort of on the heels of the No Child Left Behind Act to ensure that every third grader who was moving up to the fourth grade would meet basic reading proficiency standards. The state and the country have wrestled with this a little bit. It's all tied to the Common Core standards for education, which was an initiative by the governors of several states that got together and put these guidelines in place. And I think, unfortunately, some states have found that those guidelines are a little too stringent. The testing methods that have been used have sort of pushed schools to really teach to the tests instead of assessing the performance of the teaching. So Ohio dropped their reading assessment measure that they were using last year, and this year they're piloting a new one. And it looks like, you know, Ohio kids are actually doing much better than national average when we assess it accurately.
As far as the demographics that are involved, Scott, are there more people under the poverty level who are unable to read?
Unfortunately, there's a pretty strong association between socioeconomic status, income level, demographics, and literacy rates. So when you break that down, you know, you can go to the Ohio Department of Education websites, and you can see the numbers there. And unfortunately, it does look like there's a much lower literacy rate among certain ethnic and racial groups, and also by SES. So it really is a factor.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, in talking about dyslexia, is dyslexia something that's eventually curable?
You know, it's, as John pointed out, it really relates to neural circuits in the brain that are, to some extent, repurposed for reading. You know, we're born with all of the neurological circuitry we need for language. We start hearing our mother's voice when we're in the womb. We develop language skills naturally and very early. But reading doesn't work that way. You know, it happened much later in the history of mankind. You know, really, we started writing things down probably 6,000-7,000 years ago. So, you know, in terms of development of the brain, it hasn't had the tens of thousands of years that language have had to develop. And so we repurpose visual circuits, recognition circuits for reading. Everybody doesn't do that as efficiently as we do with language. So if you have a breakdown at any point in the process, there are effective strategies to improve that part of the performance. But there will probably tend to be a struggling reader throughout the lifespan.
Yeah, one of the goals of the Reading Center at Children's is to use neuroimaging, which is one of the technologies that we use quite a bit, to better define what's actually going on in the brain when reading breaks down with kids with dyslexia. And there's different parts of the brain that are involved, different circuits that are involved, but generally, when it comes to coming up with therapies, what has to be figured out is a workaround. So if a child is not, let's say, decoding a word properly, you need to figure out a way to help them memorize words more by sight and learn to read that way. So one of the goals at the center also is to better understand how to tailor therapies for a given child, because there are different subtypes of dyslexia, and it's not really a one-size-fits-all type of approach, and we want to help really ease the burden on parents and children to come up with the proper therapy for the proper child as early as possible.
Now, John mentioned tailoring the therapy. We think of dyslexia as being a deficit in one of the five basic pillars of reading. So we have phonemic awareness, which is the awareness of the basic sounds of language, and then phonics, which is the ability to represent those sounds with symbols. So the decoding of letters and so forth into sounds that then make words that have meaning is the process of phonological awareness. But reading also relies on fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. And so after the third grade, we really start to rely on fluency and comprehension in order for a child to begin reading to learn versus learning to read in the first and second grades. And so what we do with our assessments in the Reading Center is we test the phonemic awareness, the phonological awareness, the fluency, the vocabulary, and the comprehension. And we come up with a complete assessment that gets fed back to the parents, the pediatrician, and the teachers in terms of where the deficits are exactly. And then our treatment prescription, if you will, is designed to address specifically the areas that have the deficit. And we think about 70 to 80% of children with dyslexia have a phonemic awareness problem. So they really have a problem with hearing and decoding the sounds and letters. So that's where the focus tends to be in younger kids.
And that hinders their ability to spell and their ability to read. And
exactly.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. Thanks to Melissa Booth for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to look at local efforts to promote literacy among children are the director
of the Reading and Literacy Discovery Center at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Scott Holland, Cincinnati Children's Hospital Pediatric Primary Care Center attending physician Dr. Greg Shumless, who directs the Reach Out and Read program and Greater Cincinnati Reach Out and Read Coalition, and Dr. John Hutton, pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's and owner of the Blue Manatee Children's Bookstore. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk about some of the programs that are out there to boost literacy. And Greg, you're involved with the Imagination Library and with Reach Out and Read. Tell us first about the Imagination Library, what that is about.
So the Imagination Library is an awesome program that we just started in Cincinnati about a year ago. And as Dr. Holland said, we know that for the early learning brain, the stimulation is so important. And reading is one of the most important things we can do with young children to help reinforce the pathways that are needed for learning. And so the Imagination Library basically is a program that gets books out into the homes. Dolly Parton actually started this program back in her hometown in about 1995 just because she loves books. Her father wasn't a good reader, but he made sure all their children were educated. And Ms. Parton just grew up with a passion of learning, and she saw a great need in her hometown for books in the home. And the program has been a great success, and now you can replicate it in your community with local funding. And so with the help of Every Child Capital, we were able to bring the Imagination Library to Cincinnati about a year ago. And as I said, it mails a book directly to the home of any child enrolled from 0 to 5. So if a child is enrolled from birth, they have a library of 60 books in the home by the time the program ends. And we know from other communities where the program has been in operation for a while that there's a big impact on reading and learning. In a lot of communities, the daily readers go up from 30% to 60%, and those who read rarely go down from 10% to 1%. And actually, Middletown has had the program for a while and saw a 15% improvement in their kindergarten readiness scores.
Okay.
And in Cincinnati, we've had a tremendous success with the program. We use, we kind of piggyback with our Reach Out and Read program to enroll the children. And in just about a year now, we've enrolled 7,500 children in the Imagination Library. So that means that every month, 7,500 books are mailed out to the Cincinnati community, most of these children living in poverty. And to date, since the program started, we've already delivered 49,000 books to the community.
49,000.
49,000.
That's great. Speaking of types of books, now you're talking about a traditional book that you're distributing, right?
Correct. Yep. These are regular paper books that you touch and turn the pages.
And John, I'm just wondering where's the debate on electronic books versus traditional books? Where does that stand? Is that something you get asked about a lot?
It's an increasingly big issue. We do get asked about it quite a bit, and it really divides people into two camps broadly. You have some people that are very pro-technology that see it as an end-all be-all, sort of an evolution of the book, and some that are very suspicious of e-books and are very traditionalists and a book's a book, and I don't like it unless it has paper. I think the key issue is less about the, you know, whether e-books are like radiation or something like that and are poisonous, but it's more about the whether or not the technology, whether it's a traditional book or an e-book.
Is it more about engagement?
It's about engagement. Okay. Whether that's the secret sauce in the whole process is a book is essentially a catalyst that brings a parent and a child or another grown-up and a child together. And in that process, wonderful things happen. There's language exchange, questions, feelings, that warmth, them sitting on a lap, the whole emotional connection. And so the problem with e-books that can come up is very often the ebook has a feature that can have the device read to the child instead of the parent. They also can have interactive features that tend to be distracting. You know, you touch the screen and something beeps or flashes, and there's not a ton of research out there yet because they're so new, but the research that is there seems to imply that the simpler the book, the better, and the more engaged the parent and child, the better. So if you're going to read an e-book with a child, the key is just to make it as simple as possible for the parent and child to actually read it together, just like they would a traditional book.
See, my thoughts about an e-book would be it's something you can put away and forget about.
Yeah,
or if you have a stack of children's books laying on the table, you say, wait a minute, I need to read to my child tonight.
Right, and the books end up being like old friends. I mean, the child will carry a book around and read it over and over, turn the pages, write on it, do all kinds of things with it, and keep it forever. And the other issue with the devices is they tend to have so many other features within them that the child wants to poke around with, whether it's email or going to YouTube or whatever else it is.
And there is distractions.
There is some evidence that when a parent and child are sharing a tablet or something like that, then the conversation can be too often about the device rather than the story.
There's also, you know, for very young children, just working with a book, using their hands, learning motor skills is really important also. So there's more to a book than just the words, especially for the
So that physical young children. Presence actually has some benefits.
Definitely.
Mark, another point that John didn't make, but he deserves all the credit for it, is he did mention that we do a lot of research on reading and literacy at Cincinnati Children's and the Reading Center. And he currently has funding from the Thrasher Foundation to do a study that's aimed at exactly this question. And so using brain imaging, he's looking at the influence of simply listening to the narrative versus the narrative plus the illustrations of the book, and then comparing that with a fully animated version of the book. And I think you've gotten permission from children's book author to use some. You should tell them about this project. Not me. It's your study.
Go ahead, Joe.
You did very well. You did better than I would to describe it. The essential question in the study comes down to imagery. For young kids, how important is it for a child to imagine what's going on in the story, especially at a young age? And there is some evidence that imagery is really, really critical for learning. The child basically sees in their mind's eye what's going on in the story, and in that process can better figure out what's happening. And the question in my study is does animation short-circuit that process where the book or the animation or the cartoon or whatever starts to do the work for the child and they don't have to use their imagination anymore, or at least they don't have to as much? And so hopefully within the next year or so, we'll get some evidence to see what that actually looks like in a group of preschool kids.
513-419-7100 to join us. And let's talk to Marie in Delhi. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I actually just had one quick comment on the last bit of information that was just shared. I am a preschool and kindergarten Montessori teacher, and it was drilled into me when I was going through my training that in preschool and kindergarten, the real world is enough for a child. They don't need all of this imaginary. They need to really get into the real world and see what that's all about before they can start fantasizing and creating all of these make-believe things. So I just thought that was really interesting to hear that from you guys just now. But my question was regarding early intervention with speech and occupational therapy in young children. Do you see any difference that children who have those types of deficits can affect their language and literary development as they age?
I think you make some great points in general. First, about your being grounded in the real world, I absolutely applaud that. Children do, when they're growing up, need to have real experiences. They are new in the world and are sort of figuring out how the world works. So keeping them grounded in interactions with people and toys and other things like that is really critical. As far as deficits, there are what's called comorbidities that go with certain learning difficulties or conditions, and it is somewhat common for children that have trouble reading to have trouble doing other things as well, and whether that's from common brain pathways or whatever the case, it's a fairly, and when kids are referred, they end up very often we'll send them to speech therapy and they end up going to occupational therapy as well to kind of
If I could comment on that too. As you pointed out, Maria, very young children, the speech and language problems are often the first things that you see well before they're reading. And, especially if they're grounded in real-world activities versus books, they will be talking to their playmates, talking to their parents. What we have learned over the last few years, last couple of decades really, is that about 30% of three-year-olds who present with a speech and language delay are going to then develop a reading problem by the time they're in kindergarten. So it's really an early marker for a potential reading deficit. And one of the things that we're really interested in is, and in fact, both of my colleagues here, Dr. Zimlis and Dr. Hutton, are involved in putting a early reading screening program in place at Cincinnati Children's in our primary care clinics so that four-year-olds get a very quick reading screen. And, you know, if they're scoring low on that, we will then refer them for a more in-depth evaluation because we actually think that some of the early indicators that derive from speech and language skills are good predictors of potential reading problems, and intervening earlier is better.
Julian Franklin joins us now. Hi, Julie.
Hi. How are you?
Go right ahead. Doing well, thank you.
Hey, yeah, I'm a mental health therapist. I work in Hamilton County in homes and schools for lower income based families. And my daughter has been diagnosed severely dyslexic. And thank goodness I have a relative who is a dyslexic tester. And I really struggled with the schools getting them to even say the word dyslexia. And I'm finding that with my clients, you know, going into IEP meetings, and the schools really don't know what to do with these kids. And so I just wondered if you had any advice for me to help advocate for them.
Well, it seems like anecdotally at least, that different districts have different levels of resources to be able to care for kids that are diagnosed with dyslexia. You know, you hear a lot from families that come in they're struggling with their kids, and the most common concern is just I can't you know get the proper testing, or when I did get the testing, then I don't know what to do next. But certain districts do a wonderful job from top to bottom. You know, you're doing the testing and getting into to a consistent therapist. One of the most important things that I try to stress to families with kids with dyslexia is that this does not mean the child is not smart and cannot be successful in school. It's really, you know, dyslexia is about a specific pathway, as Dr. Holland said, you know, the brain being repurposed for reading. And I think it's so important early on that kids be encouraged to stay positive and you know, it's very common for their self-esteem to erode because they're struggling in school early on, but to really continue to let them know that there are plenty of people that are extremely successful that were diagnosed with dyslexia as children who are artists and chefs and athletes and scientists and other things. And but then one of the things we're trying to do at Children's is for families that are struggling at their school or in a certain district, that we would be another resource for them to come to get services.
As far as boosting literacy, though, is the biggest thing that a parent can do is to read to their child? Are there other things they can do?
I think, you know, reading to a child early, right from the beginning, maybe even while they're in the womb, is really stimulating, and it's a great early intervention, preventive medicine, if you will, I think is the term that John likes to use. But we also know that the dialogue between parent and child is really important. So talking to your child, directed conversation about things, as opposed to being in a room with a lot of noise and animals and televisions playing, that interactive conversation builds vocabulary, builds the phonemic awareness, the phonological awareness, understanding of sentence morphology, and all those pre-reading skills. So even if you're not reading, you know, if you're in the kitchen and it's getting to be mealtime, or you're feeding your kid, those directed conversations are really important in developing the early language and reading skills.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon. Director of the Reading and Literacy Discovery Center at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Scott Holland. Cincinnati Children's Hospital Pediatric Primary Care Center attending physician, Dr. Greg Zumlas, who directs the Reach Out and Read program and Greater Cincinnati Reach Out and Read Coalition. And Dr. John Hutton, pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's and owner of the Blue Manatee Children's Bookstore. Coming up, with the grand opening of Cincinnati streetcar system just around the corner, we'll hear how the new Kansas City streetcar is doing. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.